heartache.
Thank you. Arise in support of this legislation to protect jobs, support small businesses, and save lives.
There is more we must do, not simply for those who are at greater risk, but for all of us who wear masks, not because we don't want to be with one another, but because this pandemic has made us a risk to others, to our neighbors, our friends, our family.
We must make sure that the testing goes into the areas disproportionately affected, like the Black and brown communities.
So I support enthusiastically the rule, and as well.
And COVID-19 will undeniably exacerbate this paradigm.
Let's not let this happen again, particularly during the course of this crisis.
Madam Speaker, I have one question. Where has Congress been? 43% of American households have had a significant or total pay cut. 26 million Americans have filed for unemployment. Schools are shut down, placing burdens on families, and hospitals are laying off doctors and nurses. Where has Congress been? Congress has met twice. First, to pass a $2 trillion bill that in many cases is harming the very business it purports to help. And now again, to spend more borrowed money without asking the important questions. No hearings, no oversight. Today, I'm holding my nose, voting for a bill I had no chance to shape, because there are 700,000 businesses closed by the power of government on the outside looking in, while Harvard qualifies for $9 million. But this is it, Madam Speaker. Enough. No more half-assed legislating. No more picking winners and losers. No more asking a small restaurant to gamble, to borrow money in hopes that money will be forgiven by their government if they rehire people they can't rehire, because those same overlords are paying workers more in unemployment than to do their job. Congress must convene, not just today, but every day until America is back on track. Our job is to make policies that will save lives on moving us forward with deliberation, facts, and balanced reason, not reaction, panic, and fear. Congress should be here, Madam Speaker.
We are a body of 435 representatives. That is true. There is only one that can demand that that gavel go up and down. And I have a very simple question for this body. Can anybody, will anybody in this body stand and say that the Speaker has demanded that we act here with the urgency that our people require, with the urgency that this body is capable of? You believe this body has acted with the urgency we are capable of, that our people require?
The House will be in order. The House will be in order.
I think it is sad that there are people that believe that we have acted in urgency. There has been no haste by this body. It will be said of this time,
the gentleman's time is expired,
that those who could do the most did the least.
He looked to me like he was a little sedated. He's shredding the Constitution in his conduct. I shredded his State of His Mind address.
President, let's invite him back for a State of the Union, given what you're describing.
Well, next year we will have a new President of the United States. That is an absolute imperative for our country, for our Constitution, for the land that we love from sea to shining sea, which he degrades almost every day, but several times a week, for who we are as a people, a nation of immigrants, unless you're blessed to be born a Native American, a nation of whom he denigrates, and for our values, which he just is disloyal to the Constitution, degrades the environment, denigrates who we are as a people, and undervalues who we are as a great country that is a good country where people care about each other and where there's a sense of community. It's appalling the things that he says, and then you say to me, tearing up his falsehoods, isn't that the wrong message? No, it isn't. It's just I have tried to be gracious with him. I'm always dignified. I thought that was a very dignified act compared to my exuberance, as I said. But we will not allow any president to use that capital, that chamber of the House of Representatives, of the People's House, as a backdrop for him. Now, all presidents have guests, constant guests. That was not a State of the Union. That was a state, his state of mind. We want a State of the Union. Where are we? Where are we going? And the rest. Now, let me just show you how many guests I can draw. And let me say how I can give a Medal of Honor. Do it in your own office. We don't come in your office and do congressional business. Why are you doing that here? Quite frankly, when he started talking about someone with stage four cancer, all of that, I thought he was, I don't know which stage John Lewis's cancer is at, but when he started talking about someone with cancer, we thought he was going to talk about John Lewis, a hero in our country. Come on. So in any event, I feel very liberated. I feel very liberated. I feel that I've extended every possible courtesy. I've shown every level of respect. I say to my members all the time, there's no such thing as an eternal animosity. There are eternal friendships, but you never know on what cause you may come together with somebody who may be perceived as your foe right now. Everybody is a possible ally in whatever comes next. E pluribus unum, from anyone. They didn't know how many we'd be or how different we'd be, but they want us always to remember that we were one. And they, our founders, had their differences, as do we. So again, I extended a hand of friendship to him, to welcome him as the President of the United States, to the People's House. It was also an act of kindness because he looked to me like he was a little sedated. He looked that way last year too. But he didn't want to shake hands. That was that. That meant nothing to me. It had nothing to do with my tearing up. That came much later. And, you know, a speed reader. I just went right through that thing. So I knew what was coming when I saw the compilation of falsehoods. But then when I heard, like, the first quarter or third, I start to think there has to be something that clearly indicates to the American people that this is not the truth. And he has shredded the truth in his speech. He's shredding the Constitution in his conduct. I shredded his State of His Mind address. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. There you have it. Speaker of the House.
You should come to Chinatown. Precautions have been taken by our city. We know that there is a concern about tourism traveling all throughout the world, but we think it's very safe to be in Chinatown and hope that others will come. To everyone, you should come to Chinatown. Precautions have been taken by our city. We know that there is a concern about tourism traveling all throughout the world, but we think it's very safe to be in Chinatown and hope that others will come. To everyone, you should come to Chinatown. Precautions have been taken by our city. We know that there is a concern about tourism traveling all throughout the world, but we think it's very safe to be in Chinatown and hope that others will come. All I hear from the press is that I'm moving so swiftly that it's like a blur going by. This has been a couple of years. 2.5, we feel comfortable with all of the time that has gone into this 2.5 years.
Seeped into her brain through accidental osmosis. She misread an article from The Nation where a Michigan State economics professor documented $21 trillion in unsupported accounting adjustments from the Department of Defense. That means money was moving mysteriously in and out through an opaque budgetary system, and it's impossible to see what cancels each other out. Of course, Alexandria's reading comprehension is as solid as her basic math, so she took that to mean the Pentagon was hiding $21 trillion in a camouflage steamer trunk, and if she could find it and pry it open, it would almost single-handedly fund single-payer insurance. She tweeted, quote, $21 trillion of Pentagon financial transactions could not be traced, documented, or explained. 21T in Pentagon accounting errors, Medicare for all costs, tilde, 32T. That means 66% of Medicare for all could have been funded already by the Pentagon. And that's before our premiums. Oh, dear. That's not how it works. The total Pentagon budget for the 17-year period the study covers was only $9 trillion. And that's a lot of money. But there's not some magical stash you can trade for Band-Aids and aspirins in the cellar. My problem isn't with how Miss Ocasio-Cortez looks or what she wears or how she talks. It's that she has been thrown so many softballs, leftist interviewers are getting group rate discounts on Tommy John surgery, and she never corrects her fundamental flaws or does basic research to fix her fuzzy math. Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez called her the future of the Democratic Party. And I hope, like this recent flirtation with diet communism, that future is short-lived and soon corrected. And that's the memo.
Mass incarceration has put hundreds of thousands behind bars for minor offenses. Joe Biden wrote those laws.
Every major crime bill that's come out of this Congress has had the name Joe Biden on that bill.
We do everything but hang people for jaywalking in this bill.
Joe Biden's policies destroyed millions of black lives. Joe Biden may not remember.
Ocasio-Cortez failing to outline where all the money for her so-called free government proposals is going to come from. Here now is Dan Henninger, Wall Street Journal editorial page, deputy editor, and a Fox News contributor. And, you know, let's just talk about what she's planning to give away from the goodness of her own heart. By the way, Milton Friedman said the easiest way to give away money if it's somebody else's money, which is to say the least. But free health care, free college, free income, by the way. She's another
guaranteed income.
Guaranteed income. But she's about $38 trillion short of paying for it.
Yes. Well, I think there was a bit of a Freudian slip in that answer of hers when she started talking about waving a wand, like it's magic. Do you believe in magic? And but I think it's a serious proposition, David. What this suggests is that people like Ocasio-Cortez, the socialist, basically don't care about the price tag. They're not interested in that. The idea is that you will promise this sort of thing to millennials, that healthcare can be free, college can be free. They get elected, they get power, and they run the government. Problem is, in the places they've been allowed to do that, like, say, Detroit, bankrupt, state of Illinois, bankrupt, New Jersey, Connecticut, gasping for air because there simply isn't enough tax revenue to pay for the promises they already made.
Not to mention, by the way, all these student loan programs, which are terribly underwater, and somebody's going to have to pay for that, and naturally that's going to be the taxpayers. Meanwhile, there is a way to get free education, and Ken Langone just showed us that. One of these evil capitalists that she talks about just gave $100 million to NYU Medical Center, and med students are now getting free tuition, thanks in part to that generous list. So it's capitalism that does allow for occasional free gifts, genuine gifts from people that have the money to do it.
And there's a couple of other things capitalism does, David. She's talking about we ought to have a medical system like the UK or the Europeans. The Europeans have for decades been free riding on the pharmaceuticals created in the United States by a for-profit system and to some extent Switzerland. They use the things we have. What she's proposing, in effect, is to put a ceiling on medical innovation and medical progress because there would not be enough money to contribute to that sort of innovation. It would all be going to supporting the underlying system. And we know in the UK and Canada, it's already breaking beneath the cost of those systems.
Well, you know, in politics, you never let facts get in the way of a good argument. And there is still, despite the fact that her numbers don't add up and she hasn't even bothered to add things up, she still has appeal to a certain sector of the Democratic Party, and the head of the Democratic Party said she's the future.
Yeah,
what do they
Tom
do with
Perez.
Her?
Well, they run her in places like Queens or in New York City where you have a lot of progressive voters, but don't be deluded. The Democrats are not so stupid to run this in every congressional district around the country. In a lot of these districts, they're running many much more moderate Democrats, like the woman who's running for Rodney Frelinghuysen's seat down in, I think it's New Jersey 7, former prosecutor, former Marine, and running as a centrist Democrat. And at the state level, you have centrist Democrats, West Virginia, Indiana, North Dakota. But at the national level, where you have these presidential candidates, they have sort of joined themselves to her ideas. And I do not see, David, that that is politically viable.
We'll see. Dan Henninger, good to see you. Thank you, my friend. We'll be right back.
The Democrat socialist running for Congress right here in New York goes on the attack against Israel, calling our ally a, quote, occupation force over Palestine. Listen.
I also think that what people are starting to see, at least in the occupation of Palestine, is just an increasing crisis of humanitarian condition.
You use the term the occupation of Palestine.
I think it, what I meant is like the settlements, places where Palestinians are experiencing difficulty.
Do you think you can expand on that?
I am not the expert on geopolitics on this issue.
Well, that is clear. Here to react, Michael Knowles, host of The Michael Knowles Show. Michael, good to have you with us.
Abby, good to be here.
All right. You listen to the DNC, and that is the future of their party.
That is the future of their party. I think she's a good representative. The Democrats at this point are proudly ignorant and thoroughly anti-Israel, so it makes sense. This poor girl, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, is not making a great first impression, and that is the lasting one. What do we know about her since her campaign hit the national stage? She is a liar. She lied about her upbringing. She pretended to be from a poor part of the Bronx and grow up there. In reality, she grew up in a ritzy part of one of the ritziest counties in the country. I know this because I grew up in the town over from her. So we know that, and now we know that she is proudly ignorant. She has this great line. She says, I don't really know a lot about this, but I firmly believe, you know, frequently wrong but never in doubt. She uses the slogans that we've seen from Democrats now for the past 20 years. You know, we heard in the Bush era, Bush lied, people died. He didn't. We heard no war for oil. There wasn't one. Now we hear Trump colluded with Russia. There's no evidence of that. And the myth of Israeli-occupied Palestine, which I believe is the country east of Narnia and west of Wakanda, is another example of that. You know, Margaret Hoover in that television program scratched just below the surface, and Ocasio-Cortez had no answer. She didn't know anything. All she had learned was ideology. I think apparently Yorktown High School is not as good as we all thought it was.
So by the way,
Michael,
she's just
learned these.
To your point, she went to Boston University. She says she doesn't know geopolitics in that interview. She majored in international relations. So obviously this is something that she claims to know a lot about. Kudos to Margaret Hoover in that interview for simply listening and following up with, can you please expand on this? What I'm surprised by is she's done so many interviews since this big win a few weeks ago, and yet none of this has been exposed. What does this tell you about bigger picture of the Democratic Party?
Well, first of all, it tells you that the media are carrying water for them. Margaret Hoover has a very sort of stable, sober public affairs show. She's not exactly out to get her guests, but the guests expose themselves. If Ocasio-Cortez were smart, she would have locked herself in a closet until November. The election is hers, and all she's doing is hurting herself. And more broadly, what this tells us is there's a real problem with millennial education. You know, I'm the same age as Ocasio-Cortez. I went to a school nearby in high school, and one aspect of that is in high schools, especially in New York in those days, the curricula told you, don't worry about studying facts. Don't learn names and dates and details. Just learn broader picture trends. And I think that's the ideological component that allows a committed socialist like Miss Ocasio-Cortez to spew ignorance without knowing the basis of the things she's talking about.
Yeah, well, this was certainly, I'm sure, a wake-up call. She's in the hot seat now, so you can bet a lot of other questions will be coming her way. Michael Knowles, always good to have you with us. Very early there in Los Angeles.
People say you don't understand how the game is played. Mm-hmm. Do you?
I think it's really great for people to keep thinking that.
You want folks to underestimate you?
Absolutely. People? That's how I won my primary.
Do you believe President Trump is a racist?
Yeah. Yeah. No question.
How can you say that?
When you look at the words that he uses, which are historic dog whistles of white supremacy, when you look at how he reacted to the Charlottesville incident where neo-Nazis murdered a woman versus how he manufactures crises like immigrants seeking legal refuge on our borders, it's night and day.
Do you have a specific on the tax rate?
You know, you look at our tax rates back in the 60s, and when you have a progressive tax rate system, your tax rate, you know, let's say from zero to $75,000 may be 10% or 15%, et cetera. But once you get to like the tippy laptops on your 10 millionth dollar. Sometimes you see tax rates as high as 60 or 70%. That doesn't mean all $10 million are taxed at an extremely high rate, but it means that as you climb up this ladder, you should be contributing more.
These are politically dangerous tactics that you're using. You've heard that.
Yeah.
Do you believe it?
It's absolutely risky. It requires risk to try something new, but also we know so much of what we've tried in the past hasn't worked either.
Well, we have in mind, and my policies most closely resemble what we see in the UK, in Norway, in Finland, in Sweden.
How are you going to pay for all of this?
No one asks how we're going to pay for this Space Force. No one asked how we paid for a $2 trillion tax cut. We only ask how we pay for it on issues of housing, healthcare, and education.
One of the criticisms of you is that your math is fuzzy. The Washington Post recently awarded you 4 Pinocchios.
Oh my goodness.
For misstating some statistics about Pentagon spending.
If people want to really blow up one figure here or one word there, I would argue that they're missing the forest for the trees. I think that there's a lot of people more concerned about being precisely, factually, and semantically correct than about being morally right.
But being factually correct is important.
It's absolutely important. And whenever I make a mistake, I say, okay, this was clumsy. And then I restate what my point was. But it's not the same thing.
She is showing no signs that she's about to bow to any pressure to finally send over those articles to the Senate. I remember the House passed this historic vote 22 days ago now, but she is delayed sending them over out of concern the Senate will not hold an impartial trial. And here the speaker was today.
You will keep asking me the same question. I keep giving you the same answer. As I said right from the start, we need to see the arena in which we are sending our managers. Is that too much to ask? At some point, we would hope that we would see from them what the terms of engagement will be. I'll send them over when I'm ready. And that will probably be soon. I think we should move smartly and strategically.
Now, make no mistake, pressure is mounting. Several Democratic senators have urged Speaker Pelosi to move forward, joining the Republican call. As we mentioned, Senator Feinstein says, quote, the longer it goes on, the less urgent it becomes. Senator Joe Manchin said, quote, I think it's time to turn the articles over. What's more here, Democrats from Speaker Pelosi's own chamber want her to end this impasse. And that included, at one point, one of her House chairmen.
I think it is time to send the impeachment to the Senate and let Mitch McConnell be responsible for the fairness of the trial. He ultimately is.
But Congressman Smith's opposition did not last long this morning. He walked that back, saying that he misspoke, adding that Democrats, quote, should do everything we can to force the Senate to have a fair trial. Still, Congressman Smith is not the only House member wanting to move on. Manu Raju caught up with one Democrat from a swing district. I couldn't. It was so quick. I didn't hear. Dana Bash is CNN's chief political correspondent. You speak, you know, members of Congress flying past you. I mean, what he?
Yeah, he said, do you want them to go? He said yes.
Yes, yes. Yes.
He's on the same page as the Senate Democrat.
What are you hearing? What is Speaker Pelosi going to do?
Well, I love that you played that kind of mashup of what she said this morning, because she very clearly wants to signal, you know, don't push me. On the other hand, the pressure is there. It's there in a real way. And those two colliding sentiments, they were so clear with what happened with Adam Smith. He was on this very network.
Yes, he was.
Our John Berman, you know, it's time to do it, and then walked it back. It wasn't just because he had an epiphany. There's no question. We don't know exactly how it went down, but he's a smart guy and a serious guy. For him to have to do that, it's exhibit A, B, and C of how the House Speaker doesn't want to be pushed publicly.
Even Senator Cardin, exactly. You know, he's like, Nancy Pelosi's Nancy Pelosi.
Well,
Nancy
he's
Pelosi's
a creature of the
do.
House, exactly.
Right.
He knows what he's talking about there. Having said that, I'm told that the Speaker is signaling internally, don't go far, stay close. Not saying anything more than that. She, as Manu and Phil have been reporting, she holds her cards very close to her vest, even among her nearest and dearest. But she's saying, you know, she's signaling we're almost there.
As in maybe the next 24 hours?
Maybe the next 24 hours.
Okay.
What she is hoping, and she said this publicly, and I'm told privately as well, that Mitch McConnell, who has said, okay, fine, I'll send you over what we're planning for the Senate trial, that he actually does it. But so the hope is that happens, and that is the catalyst for her finally saying, okay, you got it. I'm gonna appoint the managers who are going to be the effective prosecutors, and I'm going to send over the articles of impeachment so the Senate trial can start. But she might not be able to wait that long. I'm also told that she understands that there are a lot of members, those members like the one Manu talked to, who are out on a limb politically back home, the so-called frontliners who are in Trump districts, and to go home one more time, even for a weekend, and without saying, yeah, it's going over
there.
Really, it's going to be very, very
really
hard
tough
for them. She understands that.
There's also more reporting I want to ask you about. This is also coming from Phil and Sarah Westwood about how President Trump's getting this conflicting information on whether to bring conservative House members onto his defense team for the impeachment trial, a la, does he want theatrics or no?
Well, it's theatrics, but it's also the people he thinks defend him the best. And the answer to who he thinks defend him the best are, you know, some of the most prominent players in the conservative side of the House Republican conference. Jim Jordan, the people we saw all during the impeachment
trial. Jim Jordan.
Ratcliffe, those figures. He loved watching that show. Mm. To have them from his perspective, and he is being encouraged to push for people like them to work alongside of his own lawyers, his own legal team in the Senate trial. Others, our colleagues, Phil and Sarah and others, are reporting that Mitch McConnell, who actually is the majority leader of the Senate,
went to the
president yesterday and said that's a bad idea because it won't help your case. Because in the Senate, the people they're trying to influence are the moderate Republicans on any given witness. The
Makes
question
sense.
Is, how are they going to vote on any given witness? And having a conservative trying to shove it down their...
Joined now by New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Congresswoman, thank you for joining us this morning. I do want to begin with that tweet from the president yesterday. We saw most Republicans did not want to comment. What did you think when you saw it?
I mean, it was horrendous and horrific. The president targeted a 75-year-old man, justice-loving man who wanted to stand up for his neighbors and wanted to stand up for his fellow Black Americans and making sure that everyone is treated equally in the eyes of the law. And to target him when everyone saw on video exactly what happened is just such a reprehensible act. And it just goes to show how far we have to go in the fight for justice in this country.
Let's talk more about that right now. The White House is taking you on for supporting the defund the police movement. But it's not just President Trump. You know, Joe Biden doesn't support defunding the police either. This morning he writes in USA Today, the better answer is to give police departments the resources they need to implement meaningful reforms and to condition other federal dollars on completing those reforms. What's wrong with that argument?
Well, I think in a lot of different places in America, we experience very different realities with the police. Here in New York City, and I happen to represent the Bronx, I have Rikers Island here in my own district. And the New York City Police Department has a $6 billion a year budget. That is more than we spend on youth, housing, healthcare, and homelessness combined in New York City. And so the problem is not a lack of resources here. In fact, many folks here in our community say that the problem is the opposite, is that not enough resources are being put into the very kinds of social programming and investments that prevent crime and social discord in the first place. And so what a lot of folks are talking about when it comes into this movement is that they're asking for the same budget priorities that many affluent suburbs already have.
Well,
and it may sound strange, but many affluent suburbs have essentially already begun pursuing a defunding of the police in that they fund schools, they fund housing, and they fund healthcare more as their number one priorities.
But why is it necessary to take the money from the police? I mean, I understand your argument, the argument you're making about expanding social services, investing in social services, but the research does show that more police on the street means less crime.
Well, I think there's one question that is interesting here is that when it comes to funds, it's not always just about the number of officers in the street. It's about these police precincts that have tanks, that have military weaponry, and frankly have a degree of material resources and warlike weaponry that people ask, why does a local police precinct have this in the first place? So when we talk about defunding, it can show up in multiple ways. Additionally, the other way that we talk about in this is that when people ask for healthcare, when they ask for housing, when they ask for education, people always say, how are you going to pay for it? And so what this movement is doing, first and foremost, it's important to note that this is directed at city councils and mayors. And so you should look to see if your city is having this conversation. But first, and the other question here too is, I think it's a valid question for people to ask, what should be our number one budget priority at all? Does any agency deserve to be funded more than almost all the others for healthcare, housing, and youth combined?
But what do you say? Excuse me, sorry. What do you say to your fellow Democrats who say the slogan defunding the police gets in the way of the argument you're making? You've even got the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, Karen Bass, saying it's a distraction.
Yeah. Well, you know, we can't necessarily, I don't think we can control what is happening right now in this moment, right? Our job as elected officials is to listen. And we can't control what, you know, that everyone is going out in the street and saying Black Lives Matter. And just a few years ago, everyone said that Black Lives Matter polled poorly, that it was divisive, that it required too much explanation. But these are everyday people going out into their community saying, this is what we want for ourselves and for our city council budgets. But, you know, what I do think is incredible, and the incredible work that House leadership has done, is that they have listened and they've introduced a sweeping bill in the Justice and Policing Act. And what Congress is trying to do is create a national registry of officers that have engaged in gross misconduct to make sure that they can't run away from accountability by hurting someone in one precinct, leaving, and then getting hired at another one.
Congresswoman, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Well, hey there, GMA fans. Rob.
When a close friend of mine learned that I was coming to this deeply revered university, he urged me to be prepared. He said, be sure to have your facts, numbers, and data points. Alas, I had to inform my friend that no such preparation was plausible, because the motion that sits before us today is the impeachment of President Donald J. Trump, a topic that made entry into the sphere of debate absent any substantive fact, born entirely of innuendo, and unmitigated anger and personal contempt. Personal contempt, like calling somebody a weak president, an odious president, a hideous president, suggesting that somebody smells like scotch, while very entertaining, is without any fact or merit. Of course, this debate, this impeachment talk, did not begin here at Oxford. Rather, peculiarly, the conversation regarding the impeachment of Donald J. Trump began the very first morning after he defeated Hillary Clinton in a stunning upset back in 2016. And so we are forced to ask ourselves here today, how is it possible that calls for his impeachment began before he even officially assumed office? First, and I recall this one quite affectionately, came the rabid charges of Russian collusion. The conspiracy theory that the Trump campaign had colluded with Vladimir Putin to influence the election results. Sadly, after 2 years of unfettered media propaganda, Democrats hero and special counsel lead prosecutor Robert Mueller ended the probe, concluding that there was absolutely no proof, zero, that any member of the Trump campaign colluded with Russia. Embarrassed, defeated, the Democrats quickly jumped to their next claim, obstruction of justice, the rather illogical charge that the incumbent president went to great lengths to obstruct the special counsel from discovering his innocence. The claim defied common sense, which is why, unsurprisingly, in March of 2019, the evidence of obstruction was officially deemed insufficient, and the corresponding charges were formally dropped. Running parallel to all of this foolishness was the extraordinary charge of campaign finance violation, a time when an unlikely Democrat hero emerged, porn star Stormy Daniels. Impeachment, the media obsessively claimed, was a plausibility because hush money was received by Ms. Daniels from the Trump campaign. The Democrats became certain that this was the story that would sink the presidency. So certain, in fact, that they transformed Ms. Daniels' lawyer, Michael Avenatti, into an overnight celebrity. Propped up as the long-awaited kryptonite to the MAGA superhero, there were public calls for Mr. Avenatti to run against Trump in 2020. More sadness, because that story collapsed too. And if you need an update, Ms. Daniels was ordered by a judge to pay Trump nearly $300,000 in legal fees. And the hush money lawsuit against the president was dismissed entirely by a judge back in March. Oh, and what of Mr. Michael Avenatti, the man once glorified by Democrats as a presidential contender? It grieves me to report that he has now been accused of financial fraud himself, indicted for extortion, fraud, and identity theft by a host of clients, including Ms. Stormy Daniels herself. Which brings us to Ukraine. Because only in the fervent madness and desperation of radicalized leftism could a man be accused of colluding with both Russia and Ukraine. Despite Ukrainian President Zelensky outright denying that any quid pro quo existed between his government and Trump, and despite the disastrous hearing yesterday before the House, which revealed that none of the alleged whistleblowers had any firsthand knowledge of the call between the two leaders, Democrats will continue to push this narrative to its natural conclusion until it collapses like all of the other false narratives under the weight of its own deception. Ladies and gentlemen, need I remind you that a president can only be impeached for committing a high crime or a misdemeanor, a crime like former Democrat President Bill Clinton committed when he lied under oath about sexual relations that he had with an 18-year-old intern in the White House. Unfortunately for Democrats, beating Hillary Clinton is not a high crime. In fact, many people, like myself, consider that to be an act of philanthropy. By now, you may have gathered that the argument I am making is one of overzealous partisanship behavior by the Democrats, but that is really just the veneer. Do not be deceived by the topical arguments today. Do not overlook the true meaning of this conflict. Recognize that what we are debating today is not left versus right, Republican versus Democrat, or liberal versus conservative. It is tyranny versus liberty. If a decision is made to impeach a president on the basis of opinion, then the republic is doomed. If personal animosity and prejudice become the basis for removing duly elected officials going forward from their offices, then the republic is doomed. Founding Father Alexander Hamilton spelled out this potential abuse of impeachment when he forewarned that such prosecution, and I quote, in many cases will connect itself with pre-existing factions and will enlist all of their animosities, partialities, influence and interests on one side or the other. And in such cases, there will always be the greatest danger that the decision will be regulated more by the comparative strength of parties than by the real demonstrations of innocence or guilt, end quote. Even in times of extraordinary political divide like today, we must remain principled. We must remain factual. And I am afraid that the basis of impeaching Trump is neither. Appropriately, Alexander Hamilton also wrote that a nation which can prefer disgrace to danger is prepared for a master and deserves one. Through the continued onslaught of these various fraudulent investigations, we not only disgrace ourselves, but we weaken our position upon the world stage. We signify to the rest of the world that Western civilization is on the brink of implosion. Within America, constitutional government is dissipating before our eyes. So, ladies and gentlemen, I have traveled 3,662 miles over the Atlantic Ocean to inform you all that you simply cannot impeach somebody that you don't like. And if the chamber would like...
I just have to say that I object strenuously to your use of the word hilarious. To me, this feels a lot like your reaction to being named in one of these manifestos. Now, you're, of course, not responsible for the words of somebody writing that document. But I do think that laughing at it is a real problem, because these are real families that are impacted by this violence. And I think our efforts towards talking about this have to start from a place of mutual respect, which is what I've heard from this side of the table. Now, the reason we don't have those numbers, I want those numbers as much as you do, but the number, to say the numbers don't show something is simply not supported by the data.
Okay, and I have 38 seconds left, Ms. Mulligan, if you want to respond within that time.
The only thing I would add is that it's in the name. Terrorism, domestic terrorism, it terrorizes us. It terrorizes us in our homes. It terrorizes us in our schools. And to the points made by the other panelists, it is disproportionate to its impact on any individual life. It's not.
You reject the idea it's something that doesn't matter or doesn't really matter?
Absolutely reject.
Okay. All right, so here's where we are. Every member now has had 5 minutes in. Okay, and Mr. Clay, so we have two members who have not. So I'm going to go to the two members who have not yet, and we'll give an opportunity for a closing thought to any member who wants before we go.
Am I next to respond, or is Mr. Meadows?
I thought Mr. Meadows was next.
Mr. Meadows, okay.
Mr. Meadows next, and Mr. Clay, then to you, Mr. Jordan.
Ms. Owens, obviously this is a gang up on you. You know, we're giving these witnesses the ability to do a rebuttal on you. And so, I find it unfair, Ms. Ballou. I mean, you know, candidly, for you to show mutual respect and then you to go after Ms. Owens, it's not appropriate. So, Ms. Owens, you can have 4 minutes and 34 seconds to respond.
Can
I
yield for a second?
I'll yield.
Thank you. I believe, Ms. Owens, when you used the word hilarious, it was referencing the fact that no one had asked you a question. It wasn't to the subject matter of the hearing. Is that right?
That is correct.
And to have another witness insinuate something that is not accurate is just not appropriate, Mr. Chairman, for how witnesses are supposed to behave in front of this committee. I also think you didn't say it doesn't matter about the subject matter of today's hearing. You said there are other subjects that matter as well, and maybe we should spend some time on those. Is that accurate?
That is correct, and they matter much, 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 much more. And I have said that. I said that in my opening, and I will say it again. You know that white supremacy and white nationalism is nowhere near, ranks nowhere near the top of the issues that are facing Black America. And the reason that you are bringing them up in this room is because it is attempt to make the election all about race as the Democrats.
Not in my case, Ms. Owens. I'm sorry. Please do not characterize my motive.
Mr. Chairman, it's my time.
Yeah,
it's my time.
You've got your time, Mr. Meadows. Give you 3 more seconds.
3-4 years, you bring up race, and you knew exactly what I meant when I said hilarious, and you just tried to do live what the media does all the time to Republicans, to our president, and to conservatives, which you tried to manipulate what I said to fit your narrative, okay? I was not referring to the subject matter that is hilarious. I said it's hilarious that we are sitting in this room today, and I've got two doctors and a missus, and nobody can give us real numbers that we can respond to so we can assess how big of a threat this is. Because you know that it is not as big of a threat as you are trying to make it out to be so that you can manipulate. And the audacity of you to bring up the Christchurch shooting manifesto and make it seem as if I laughed at people that were slaughtered by a homicidal maniac is, in my opinion, absolutely despicable. And I think that we should be above that. To try to assign reality or any meaning to a homicidal maniac writing a manifesto, which, by the way, let the record show, also stated Spyro the Dragon, the child's cartoon, as a source of inspiration. He also cited Nelson Mandela as a source of information. I don't think that Nelson Mandela has inspired mosque shootings. You can correct me if you think I'm wrong. You would rather assign meaning to a homicidal maniac than to actually address the things that I said today that are actually harming Black
people. Zuckerberg, what year and month did you personally first become aware of Cambridge Analytica?
I'm not sure of the exact time, but it was probably around the time when it became public. I think it was around March of 2018. I could be wrong, though.
Mm-hmm. When did Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg become aware of Cambridge Analytica?
I don't know off the top of my head.
You don't know. Did anyone on your leadership team know about Cambridge Analytica prior to the initial report by The Guardian on December 11th, 2015?
Congresswoman, I believe so, and that some folks were it internally.
And
so I actually, as you're asking this, I do think I was aware of Cambridge Analytica as an entity earlier. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I was tracking how they were using Facebook specifically.
When was the issue discussed with your board member, Peter Thiel?
Congresswoman, I don't know that often.
You don't know. This was the largest data scandal with respect to your company that had catastrophic impacts on the 2016 election. You don't know?
Well, Congresswoman, I'm sure we discussed it after we were aware of what happened.
Okay. You announced recently that the official policy of Facebook now allows politicians to pay to spread disinformation in 2020 elections and in the future. So I just want to know how far I can push this in the next year. Under your policy, you know, using census data as well, could I pay to target predominantly black zip codes and advertise them the incorrect election date?
No, Congresswoman, you couldn't. We have, even for these policies around the newsworthiness of content that politicians say and the general principle that I believe that...
But you said you're not going to fact-check my ads.
We have, if anyone, including a politician, is saying things that can cause, that is calling for violence or could risk imminent physical harm or voter or census suppression, mm-hmm. when we roll out the census suppression policy, we will take that content down.
So you will, there is some threshold where you will fact check political advertisements. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, Congresswoman, yes, for specific things like that, where there's imminent risk of harm.
Could I run ads targeting Republicans in primaries saying that they voted for the Green New Deal?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Would I be able to run advertisements on Facebook targeting Republicans in primaries saying that they voted for the Green New Deal? If you're not fact-checking political advertisements, I'm just trying to understand the bounds here. What's fair
Congresswoman,
game?
Congresswoman, I don't know the answer to that off the top of my head.
You don't know if I'll be able to do that.
I think probably.
Do you see a potential problem here with a complete lack of fact-checking on political advertisements?
Well, Congresswoman, I think lying is bad, and I think if you were to run an ad that had a lie, that would be bad. That's different from it being, in our position, the right thing to do to prevent your constituents or people in an election from seeing that you had lied.
But you won't take down lies or you will take down lies? I think it's just a pretty simple yes or no.
Congresswoman,
I'm not talking about spin. I'm talking about actual disinformation.
Yes, in most cases, in a democracy, okay. I believe that people should be able to see for themselves what politicians that they may or may not vote for
so
are
you
saying
won't take
judge
them
their
down.
Character for themselves.
So you won't take, you may flag that it's wrong, but you won't take it down.
Congresswoman, it depends on the context that it shows up, organic post, ads.
Okay. One more question. In your ongoing dinner parties with far-right figures, some of who advance the conspiracy theory that white supremacy is a hoax, did you discuss so-called social media bias against conservatives, and do you believe there is a bias?
Congresswoman, I don't remember everything that was in the question.
That's all right. I'll move on. Can you explain why you've named the Daily Caller, a publication well-documented with ties to white supremacists, as an official fact-checker for Facebook?
Congresswoman, sure. We actually don't appoint the independent fact-checkers. They go through an independent organization called the Independent Fact-Checking Network that has a rigorous standard for who they allow to serve as a fact checker.
So you would say that white supremacist tied publications meet a rigorous standard for fact checking? Thank you.
Congresswoman, I would say that we're not the one assessing that standard, the International Fact Checking Network.
Alex from the Block is back with her Instagram live stories featuring IKEA furniture and a whole lot of incomprehensible and head-scratching garble.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, sister. I'm not doing this. I'm an adult. The latest claim from Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is that on our southern border, the detention centers, where the apprehended illegal aliens stay until a decision is made about their status, those detention centers are actually concentration camps. Yes, it's as dumb as it sounds. Roll clip.
The United States is running concentration camps on our southern border, and that is exactly what they are. They are concentration camps. And if that doesn't bother you, whatever. I want to talk to the people that are concerned enough with humanity to say that we should not, that never again means something.
By saying never again, AOC made a specific reference to the Holocaust. She can't deny she was referencing this specific time in history, though she's trying to do that. Thus, she is stating that illegal immigration in America is comparable to Nazi Germany. It's just another opportunity for the left to somehow Kevin Bacon their way into calling Trump the new Hitler. And AOC did call Trump a fascist just a couple of breaths later, as she spent the entire live video rambling about pretty much everything.
Let's see, minimum wage, Medicare for all. We need to make colleges, public colleges, tuition free. Community college, vocational school, and public and state school should be tuition free, as well as a bevy of other issues.
It was a concentration camp comparison that sparked the most controversy and triggered her into a really, really bad attempt at a history lesson on the Twitter. And for the shrieking Republicans who don't know the difference, concentration camps are not the same as death camps. Concentration camps are considered by experts as the mass detention of civilians without trial. Thanks, AOC, for clearing that up. Oh, sorry, that was racist of me. White supremacy and all. Guess we're good. I visited one of those concentration camps AOC defined for us. It was Sachsenhausen, just north of Berlin, Germany. I saw the gas chambers and the open field where the Nazis freely executed. But it was defined as a concentration camp, not a death camp. I ponder. There was some truth AOC said during her video, which no one else seems to have picked up on. Immediately before her concentration camp assertion, she admitted her intentions.
Like, if you want to, like, raise your red flag and, like, put lasers out of my eyes and little devil horns, do what you got to do. But understand that this is a generational shift and the future belongs to us.
Red flags, laser eyes, and devil horns. Such imagery. But remember, you bigots out there, we literally can't take her at her word. After all, she was just speaking off the cuff and can't be taken literally when she says things like, we are literally going to die in 12 years when the earth implodes because we never implemented the Green New Deal. She literally is just saying things while trying to build IKEA furniture. So back off.
She has a different usage of words and certain maybe a different perception.
Sorry, I just wanted to frighten you again. Yes, AOC does have a different perception. And that perception is that she is not an ideologue. She's the logical one.
I think of myself as rather pragmatic, and I think of myself as looking at the logical ends and consequences of past policies and saying, how did we get here and how can we alter our future?
Let's look at the logic then, because it's pretty amazing to me just how many people are coming to America so they can see our concentration camps at the border. It's astonishing. About 144,000 were just apprehended in the past month. And I think the heads of Walt Disney better keep an eye on this situation. The people who go to Disney World are just tourists and actually leave after a week, but our system finds a way for the illegals to stay for pretty much ever. Disney really needs to capitalize on that investment. Think about it though. If our concentration camps are desired over living in Honduras and Venezuela, then what the blimey is happening in those countries? I know, the people are just eating dogs to survive. The truth is, all of these people made a choice. They did not have to illegally cross any border, thereby choosing to take the risk of being detained by the authorities of the nation they are illegally entering. But if you think of the actual concentration camps, you think of Germany and you think of Poland in the 1930s and early 40s, when families were unwillingly ripped from their beds, separated into lines, and told to march with guns being held at the back of their heads. There's a difference, a big one.
Huge.
Life is about choices, but AOC wants to make those choices for you and tell you what she believes is correct, because it's about her truth. Feelings first. Fine then, go ahead and speak your truth, AOC.
Today, Junior?
Let's try this one more time.
The fact that concentration camps are now an institutionalized practice in the home of the free is extraordinarily disturbing.
Swing and a huge miss. It's the land of the free, home of the brave. And it's because of those brave that we are free. Just stop, AOC. How it is that you're a member of Congress is what's really disturbing here. AOC continues to be a shining example of the failed education system in this, the land of the free, and the home of the brave. And because she can't help herself, or she is just following the script, AOC had to continue the fight via Twitter. My heroes are the ones who stood up when it wasn't easy. Kids are dying in cages on our border. Families are being put in freezers and dog pounds. Years from now, people will look for the journalists, officials, and everyday people who stood up for what was right in real time. The air quotes imply they are not literally being put in freezers and dog pounds, right? And journalists standing up for what's right? I don't even have time to explain that stupidity. Back on Twitter, AOC also feigned outrage against Representative Liz Cheney, who just wants her to learn some history and know that 6 million Jews were exterminated in the Holocaust. And then AOC was invited by a member of the Polish parliament to visit the former sites of concentration camps, an opportunity any American citizen should cordially accept. But this is how you know she done messed up.
If you want to criticize the shameful treatment of people at our southern border, fine. You'll have plenty of company. But be careful comparing them to Nazi concentration camps, because they're not at all comparable, in the slightest.
When Chuck Todd of MSNBC is fact-checking you and calling your words a tremendous disservice to the detainees, that ain't good for your messaging. Of course, the sycophants were there to defend AOC all week long, and some are now attacking Chuck Todd for breaking ranks. Because this is the one consistency of the left. If you are not lockstep, they will destroy you, no matter how loyal you have been to that point in time. We really could go on forever. Just remember, the only death camps that are being run in America today are in the buildings labeled Planned Parenthood, as every day they exterminate 900 helpless children. Keep focused on the true atrocities happening in our country and fighting for real justice, not the fake outrage put out by AOC and her comrades while building IKEA furniture. Until next time, stay healthy, America.
Primary.
I think I'll probably vote for Bernie. Him as a human being, when I was hanging out with him, and yeah. I believe in him. I like him. I like him a lot. What Bernie stands for is a guy who, well, look, you could dig up dirt on every single human being that's ever existed if you catch them in their worst moment and you magnify those moments and you cut out everything else and you only display those worst moments. That said, you can't find very many with Bernie. He's been insanely consistent his entire life. He's basically been saying the same thing, been for the same thing his whole life. And that, in and of itself, is a very powerful structure to operate from.